This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In 2022, a supervolcano in the South Pacific changed the atmosphere. The next 2 years far exceeded temperature records. Everyone feels the heat. Could that eruption cause a temporary burst of heat? A few voices claim this natural cause brought record warming and not our fossil fuel burning. The unique eruption did raise big questions. Now qualified scientists have the answer. Published July 24, 2024, lead author Mark Schoberl explains. The paper title is Evolution of the Climate Forcing During the 2 Years After the Hunga Tonga Hunga Hapai Eruption. After retiring from NASA in 2009, Dr. Mark Schoberl is chief scientist of the Science and Technology Corporation. With over 200 publications, Mark is one of the experts on the stratosphere. Mark Schoberl, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Volcanoes erupt sometimes. Mount Etna is active as we speak. Why was this Hunga eruption in 2022 so fascinating and important? Maybe first start with what happened.
Well, Tonga sits, the island of Tonga, the nation, sits on a subduction zone between the Australian and the Pacific plate. And your listeners may know that subduction zones are the locus of many massive volcanoes. For example, Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens in the U.S. However, Hunga is a submarine volcano, and erupting magma encountered a bunch of seawater, and it led to this massive explosion. The shockwave traveled around the world and back. Material was thrown 50 kilometers, which is about 31 miles, straight up. No modern volcano has erupted material that high, and Hunga threw a huge amount of water into the stratosphere, about 10% of the total of the stratosphere. That's a global total of stratospheric water, which is a lot. But you have to also remember the stratosphere is very, very dry, so one event can do a lot. The water vapor concentration in the stratosphere, for example, is about 1,000 times lower than it is at the ground. It was a big impact on the stratosphere.
So well above the clouds and the weather, the stratosphere is a pretty strange layer. It's not easy to study. Is it true the stratosphere can get colder even as the world below gets warmer?
Well, first of all, the stratosphere is where the ozone layer resides. It's a layer that protects life on Earth from harmful ultraviolet radiation. So it is strange in that sense. The amount of ozone, if it were at the surface, would kill us all. But in the stratosphere, it really does us a good thing. But the example you gave is the stratosphere is going to get colder as global warming continues. Well, this is an example of what's called cooling to space. So the stratosphere, the molecules in the stratosphere radiate directly to space because there's so little air up there. Whereas on the ground, the molecules interact with each other. So CO2 radiates to another CO2 and back. So the radiation is trapped in the lower atmosphere. But in the stratosphere, the radiation just goes out. So when you increase the amount of CO2, you have more radiators and the temperature gets colder. Whereas when you increase CO2 in the lower atmosphere, you get more trapping and the temperature gets warmer.
Okay, so why is an injection of water vapor into the stratosphere significant for global warming?
Well, water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and we don't normally talk about water vapor much as a greenhouse gas because you really can't add and subtract water vapor. It's controlled by the oceans, et cetera. But it does emit and absorb infrared radiation, and stratospheric water is pretty constant, about 3 to 5 parts per million. Again, it's a pretty low number. So a number of years ago, there was a small natural drying event in the stratosphere. The water vapor went down about 10 to 20%, and Susan Solomon, who worked on explaining the ozone hole, and her colleagues showed that this small reduction in stratospheric water vapor would cause some global cooling and mask the slow upward march of global temperatures. Basically, the water vapor in the stratosphere contributed enough downwelling radiation so that when you remove the water vapor, you get an effect. But the opposite is this case. In case of Hunga Tonga, we have all this water being added to the stratosphere, and therefore the concern is that will go in the other direction. Instead of slowing global warming, that will increase global warming. And there are a couple papers, or at least one paper in Nature, by a guy named Jenkins, who said that we would cross over the the 1.5 degree threshold sooner because of this Hunga Tunga volcanic eruption.
Did the new atmospheric water vapor stay in the region? Did it stay in the southern hemisphere? What happened to it?
Well, that's a good question. So initially it shot up at about 20 south, which is the location of the Tonga. And it's, you know, within about the first month and a half, it slowly spread around in mostly the southern hemisphere. It's very isolated into the southern hemisphere for maybe about the first 9 months or so, and then it slowly began to move upward and into the northern hemisphere. Now the water vapor is spread around globally, and the water vapor is starting to come out of the stratosphere. The lifetime of air or an injection, a volcanic ejection in the stratosphere is somewhere between 3 and 5 years. The circulation air goes up into the stratosphere near the tropical tropopause, and then it comes down at higher latitudes, extratropics, and that circulation process is 3 to 5 years. And we know this from lots of cases of even going back to old nuclear bomb tests, but we track the long-lived tracers and stuff and how long they take to get out of the stratosphere. So the water's coming out slowly now, but we think about time constants of 3 to 5 years for the stratospheric water from the Hunga eruption.
And there's some continuing scientific discussion on this, as you say. In May 2024, Martin Jucker and co-authors used chemistry climate models to find, well, the title of the paper is Long-Term Climate Impacts of Large Stratospheric Water Vapor Perturbations. But as we read in their abstract, they, quote, neglect the relatively minor aerosol loading from the eruption. And your new paper has aerosols all over it. Mark, please remind us what aerosols are found in these remote high spaces, and can we leave them out?
So let's go back to volcanics in the past. So the biggest volcano that we had that satellites could really measure was Pinatubo. And we've had some number of smaller ones since then, but that's one of the big ones. And it generated a lot of aerosols. So what happens is the volcano throws a bunch of SO2 into the stratosphere, and the SO2 oxidizes and forms small sulfuric acid droplets, which sort of shroud the Earth. They reflect the sunlight. And for every volcano that we've ever looked at, that's been the primary effect. That is, they block the sunlight and cool the surface. And we saw after Pinatubo that there was definitely a cooling of surface. There's some debate about how much, but maybe a half degree globally. So most of the volcanoes don't put up much water. They just put up this SO2 and then forms aerosols. Hunga Tunga also put up aerosols. It didn't put up as much as is normally seen for a volcano of this magnitude. And we think that maybe some of the aerosols got scrubbed out. But we do know that aerosols are the dominant effect of volcanoes. And I might add that there's been some of these geoengineering ideas associated with adding SO2 to the stratosphere to create an aerosol layer that would block some of the sunlight and reduce the effects of global warming. And, of course, that every time you do geoengineering, you end up with a whole host of other problems. But that idea is based on studies of the Pinatubo aerosol cloud. Martin's paper wasn't necessarily wrong in leaving out aerosols in the sense that the aerosols settle out within the first 2 years or so. So on the long term, the aerosols probably aren't very important, and the water vapor dominates the radiative forcing. But for the first 2 years, the aerosols overwhelm the effect of the water vapor, according to my study and two other papers that are in preprint. They come to the same conclusions.
Well, scientific discussion is natural, especially when a novel volcano blows up before our satellite eyes. But this event took on legendary powers for some people. It was amplified by the Climate Change is All Natural crowd. Climate denial blogs echoed an article by a retired neurobiologist. He said extreme heat in 2023 and 24 was caused by the Hunga eruption, perfectly natural. What does the science say?
Well, my calculations show that the aerosol shroud associated with, even though it was smaller than a volcano that size, overwhelmed the increased IR flux from the water vapor in the stratosphere. That was valid for the first 2 years. So the net effect was cooling, not warming. And so it would be hard to explain the 2023 warm temperatures with a volcano cooling the atmosphere. So I would say that there are people that have certain beliefs that the climate can't change or whatever. They just latched onto this without doing any calculations as such. But, you know, we should always be welcome different perspectives, in my opinion. You know, even non-atmospheric scientists can have some good ideas. And the fact that they are confused or they don't understand something means that we haven't done, as scientists, a good job explaining our science, which is why your podcast is really welcome.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. So we're talking about invisible gases, Mark, and particles spread out widely in the upper atmosphere, some measured in parts per billion. How can scientists measure what's going on up in the stratosphere, and how confident are you in your conclusions?
I'm pretty confident in the conclusions. The stratospheric aerosols and trace gases have been measured since the mid-90s. We've had really good atmospheric measurements with high vertical resolution in the stratosphere. So the appearance of the ozone holes spurred a lot of research and investment in stratospheric instruments, looking out at the limb of the atmosphere and making measurements. And we have done a lot, the community, I should say, has done a good job of validating their measurements. So we fly aircraft around that can fly into the stratosphere. We look at the satellite measurements. We look at use ground-based instruments that are like LIDARs, for example, to measure aerosol amounts and trace gases. And these generally agree with each other. So we have a pretty good feeling that what we're measuring is accurate. The main instrument that I used is a microwave instrument that was launched in 2004. Because it's making measurements in the microwave, it can measure water vapor and ozone quite clearly through the aerosol clouds, that the aerosols don't disrupt the measurements. For the aerosol measurements, we're using other LIM instruments that have been launched on NOAA satellites, and there's another instrument on the space station called SAGE. And they have been making aerosol measurements since about 2014. So we have really good suite of measurements in place when the Hunga Tunga volcano went up. Now, as for the future, that's another question. A lot of these instruments are being retired.
They're being retired, and so far no satellite replacements are coming up?
Well, yeah, that's a whole other issue. You know, there are proposed missions to replace the ones that's being retired. So in 2006, the main instrument, the microwave instrument called MLS, Microwave Limb Sounder, it's on the Aura satellite, and Aura was part of the EOS group of satellites, and it's going to be deorbited because it's running out of fuel, and they just have enough fuel to bring it down safely into the Pacific Ocean. So at that point, we'll have a big gap in our measurements. We don't have really anything to replace it. There are some smaller instruments still going, but these are also well beyond their lifetime. We may have a deficit stratospheric measurements for a number of years. Even if these other instruments are confirmed, it takes a while to build them and test them and get them in up there. So there's going to be a gap.
Well, that can be serious in science because we need to often have just a continuous series of measurements to know what directions things are going in. And this is climate change we're talking about. It's pretty important.
Yeah. And the other reason for not having a gap is you can cross-calibrate your measurements, which is pretty important so that you have a continuous record that doesn't have big jumps in it.
Well, that said, the undersea explosion in the South Pacific, it was astounding. Has it still left experts with questions and work to do?
Well, yeah, that's really true. For example, if you look at how the models have simulated the eruption actually pushed a little bit of material into the Northern Hemisphere within the first 2 months. And no model has been able to simulate that. And we don't really know why this eruption at 20 South ended up in a little bit into the Northern Hemisphere, but no model has been able to do that. So we don't really have a good idea what's going on there. And there's also some controversy about the lifetime of water vapor in the stratosphere. We thought we understood that pretty well from our measurements, but it looks like the latest measurements I've seen, the water vapor amount is not coming down as fast as we thought it might. A third thing that is quite interesting is we had a prediction, at least initially, that there might be a larger than normal ozone hole after the eruption. So the idea was that the aerosols associated with the eruption and some of the water vapor would have gotten into the Antarctic and changed the chemistry of the ozone hole a little bit, and there would have been a bigger ozone hole. In fact, that didn't happen. You know, the ozone hole was quite relatively normal. It was a little bit bigger, but it wasn't astounding. So that prediction was wrong, too. So clearly there's some work that needs to be done. And I have to say that natural events like this really test the models, and they help us figure out what we're not doing quite right. You know, we can simulate everything that's going on right now, but you get a big extraordinary event that pushes the models into a new domain. Then you find out whether your parameterizations and the way your understanding of the system works is correct or not. So this is a learning experience for all of us.
This is Radio EcoShock. Alex is speaking with Dr. Mark Shubrel, Chief Scientist at the Science and Technology Corporation, about a volcano and global heating.
And what you said also has applications for geoengineering, which you raised. I know that I've talked to one scientist some years ago who said, well, we could just put some aerosols up over the Arctic and save the Arctic ice, and then we'd still have the albedo from that. But as you've explained, it spreads to the other hemispheres and just generally moves around the world. You can't just keep it in the Arctic.
Yeah, that's a common misunderstanding that it turns out there's only one atmosphere. We don't have the atmosphere over France, and we don't have the atmosphere over Florida. When you want to geoengineer, you're geoengineering the entire planet because everything spreads around. And so that is a concern. I have another concern about geoengineering, which is it sounds good, but it actually, I think to some extent, it's being used a little bit of a distraction away from what we really need to do, which is control carbon emissions. And if people are always saying, oh, there's geoengineering, well, we can solve the problem with geoengineering. That's really not, and that technology is untested. We don't know what the impacts are going to be, and it may be very, very expensive. People have talked about every SpaceX launch would carry, 20 tons of sulfur into the stratosphere and drop it off and hopefully develop an aerosol shroud. Well, do you think really that's going to happen? I mean, that sounds nice, but I think the real issue is going to be controlling carbon emissions, and that includes methane and CO2. That's the fun of, and even if we control them now, the lifetime of those gases, or at least CO2, is so long that we're still going to have some effects. So I'm kind of a skeptic about geoengineering, and if people decide to do it, they better really carefully look at it, both the cost and the secondary impacts that might happen. And it's got to be a global agreement on doing that. You just can't have one country decide to geoengineer the whole planet, right?
Yes. Well, in my nightmare, some billionaire does it just to protect their own country, they think. Anyway, I'd like to move on because your own work and publication goes back a long way, at least to 1976. And I looked into one of your earliest papers, and I thought, I'd like to read that. The title is The Structure of Stationary Planetary Waves in Winter in Relation to the Polar Night Jet Intensity. Wow. Does that bring back any memories? You could not have known how urgent your studies would become for the future of humanity.
Right. Yeah. So I was, for my degree, my physics degree, I was working on wave dynamics, fluid mechanics, basically, in the atmosphere. I got interested, and my advisor asked me to work on wave dynamics in the stratosphere. And the stratosphere is really an interesting reason to study because there's no water vapor, as I pointed out earlier, so you don't have these complicating issues of water vapor forcing, heat release, etc. Yeah, and then, I was working on that stuff and stratospheric circulation, and it was really interesting. And then the ozone hole came along, and all of a sudden, a lot of us atmospheric dynamists and chemists who were kind of working off on other things got swept up into the ozone hole controversy. And, well, not controversy as much, like trying to explain it, what was going on there. And it surprised the entire community, just like some of the elements of Hunga Tunga have surprised the community. And so working on the ozone hole, the part I feel I contributed to was understanding why the ozone hole is contained into the region is. It turns out that the strong polar vortex region provides a barrier to transport. So the chemistry is isolated in the south polar regions, south polar stratosphere, and it can do its thing down there without being disrupted by the rest of the atmosphere. It's a temporary phenomenon. I mean, the vortex only exists during southern hemisphere winter, but it turned out that wasn't important. The chemistry, which I didn't actually think was right, turned out to be the most important part of that, understanding how chlorine could be released on polar stratospheric clouds. That was a pretty interesting area to research.
Mark, you worked on cloud maps a decade or so ago, and for one thing, anybody installing big solar should take a look for best locations. Are those cloud maps still viable today?
So at the time I was looking at that, NRO, which is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which you can go to, you can Google NRO, and you can find out what the solar power potential is for your location. They were not using cloud maps. Now they are. They include cloud maps in their forecasts. But I got interested in solar power, and I got interested in doing the calculation correctly. So that including cloudiness, which, you know, how important is that, and how much can you expect a reduction in solar power as a result of clouds. I also ended up using that kind of thing for asking the question whether how often can satellites see the surface. So, for example, in some areas of the globe, there's so much cloud that the satellites, even if they come over frequently, rarely see the surface. So those are two aspects of the same problem. And, yeah, these cloud maps are still relevant. In fact, they're better than they used to be because we have a lot more data than we did back 10 years ago. And the data I use is from AQUA, NASA's AQUA satellite, and Terra satellites. And nowadays we have that kind of data coming from the NOAA satellites using the VIRS sensor. And in addition, we have something called ABI, which is on GOES 16 and GOES 18. And those are really wonderful sensors that have been put up. And they get information about every half hour on the cloud map. So there's a lot more information than there was when I started looking at this. But it's very important that you include these in your calculation. There's some places that are really, really cloudy, and you wouldn't want to put solar power arrays up. And there are some places that are really clear. For example, you might expect the deserts of North Africa to be really clear. And the American Southwest is a good place for solar power. But Vermont, maybe not so much, because it's pretty cloudy in Vermont.
The other thing about cloud maps, maybe we can get better at predicting how cloud cover will change as the world warms and systems change. How close are we to knowing how clouds work at a planetary scale?
That's a hard question to answer. I would say that we're getting better and better at it. Clouds are one of the major feedback mechanisms. So if you increase clouds, you would reflect solar radiation, and that would cool the climate. But it depends on what cloud altitude is. For example, if you have low clouds like stratus, they're really good at cooling the climate because they're right down low and they don't add any infrared downward flux. So, for example, if you have a cloud up high, like a cirrus cloud, that can actually warm the climate because at night we have cooling out into the vastness of outer space, which is really cold. But if there's a cirrus cloud in the way, it's actually radiating at the temperature of the cirrus cloud downward. So it's like having a little oven radiator above you. So clouds and climate are a complex problem. Not only do you have the frequency of clouds, and you also have to worry about the altitude of the clouds. So this is a really complicated problem, and we're getting better at it, but we're still not there yet, in my opinion.
Yes, I had one atmospheric scientist call clouds the last frontier. What are you working on these days, Mark?
What am I working on? Well, I've got an idea for a sensor that could fill that gap I talked about between when AURA's MLS instrument ceases functioning and help fill the gap for stratospheric measurements. I'm working on convection and improving water vapor in the upper troposphere, which turns out is a hard problem. And I'm working on a couple other things, including the role of fires. We've been seeing increasing amounts of fires in high latitude regions, so Canada, Siberia, and Montana, et cetera. The smoke from those fires actually gets into the stratosphere, and it has a similar effect to volcanoes. produces an aerosols in the stratosphere, which can actually block the sunlight. And also it changes the amount of clouds in the upper troposphere. So that's another area I'm sort of interested in because of this increasing trend in fires and higher latitudes. And that's a direct result of global warming, is this warming of the higher latitude regions. That's predicted, by the way. All the warming models predict that you're going to get warmer at higher latitudes. That dries out the forests. They ignite. They get smoke. Smoke gets into the stratosphere, and it causes all kinds of interesting things to happen. So that's another area I'm really interested in working on.
Well, I'll be interested, too, to see how much that smoke cooling is offset over time by the extra carbon that's being released from all those tree trunks and just everything burning. That's a big burst of new carbon up into the atmosphere, too. And the forests, due to climate change, don't seem to be regrowing and recapturing at the same rate.
Yeah, you're actually right. And in addition to the carbon, the smoke in the atmosphere and the CO2 release, there's also quite a bit of methane is released by forest fires. So you have, kind of a double whammy there. That's a really active area of research, and a lot of people are working on that problem right now. I don't know what we can do about it other than point out the issue. You know, we're well on our way to a warming world, and it's stand by and stand back. You know, it's going to be really interesting in the future.
We've been speaking with Dr. Mark Schoberl. He's the lead author of a new paper finding that the Hunga eruption in the South Pacific in 2022 did not cause the extreme heat in the last 2 years. And you can find links to this open access paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Oh, I couldn't be happier. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website.